Hi, this is David Rose, author of Lovecraft's Iraq, and you are listening to the HP Lovecast podcast.
Hello, and welcome to episode 54 of the HP Lovecast podcast. This is Michelle Brittany, editor of James Bond in Popular Culture and the Bram Stoker-nominated Horror in Space. I write on all things pop culture with a special emphasis on the horror, fantasy, and spy genres.
And I'm Nicholas Dyack. I'm a pop culture scholar of Peplum Films, industrial music, horror studies, and I'm the editor of The New Peplum from McFarland. Michelle and I also co-edited Horror Literature from Gothic to Postmodern, also from McFarland.
In today's episode, we will be discussing the 1987 film Prince of Darkness, directed by John Carpenter. This is the second film of his apocalypse trilogy that begins with The Thing from 1982 and concludes with In the Mouth of Madness, 1994. Before starting our discussion, here's a plot synopsis of the film.
Los Angeles, the late 80s. An elderly priest passes away, leaving behind a box with a key inside. Father Donald Pleasance investigates, leading him to an old church, which, in its hidden and locked basement, contains a giant canister with a swirling, physics-defying green substance in it. Father Pleasance calls up Grandpa from the Three Ninjas films for assistance. Gather your brightest students. We're going to spend the weekend in this creepy church and do sciencey things on it. Soon, students from physics and language departments arrive, setting up shop for the weekend slumber party, and get to work studying the canister, which is able to trickle goo up to the ceiling, shoot beams telepathically, and be ingested by folks until it finds a suitable host to birth Satan, which is in turn will pull the anti-god out of a mirror. Any student or faculty member who tries to flee the church is killed by hypnotized transients outside. Any student or faculty member caught inside will be bludgeoned to death or possessed. All seems lost until, as Satan is pulling the anti-god through a mirror, Father Pleasance attacks with an axe, but he's repelled. Okay, so all seems lost again. But wait! Until another student runs in and sacrifices herself by body-tackling Satan into the mirror world. Her boyfriend is not pleased. So, before we get started, we should say how this came about because we have not seen Prince of Darkness before. Earlier this month, I was on a podcast of Fan to Fan talking about In the Mouth of Madness, and Michelle and I were like, wait a second, Apocalypse Trilogy, we've seen all these other John Carpenter films, this is a perfect time to talk about Prince of Darkness, and so here we are. So with that in mind, Michelle, what are your initial thoughts of Prince of Darkness?
Well, overall, I think the religious, the scientific, and the futuristic concepts presented in the film are fascinating. But I felt, unfortunately, I just don't believe that Carpenter was able to tie those themes together into really a cohesive narrative for the audience. I felt like in his effort to put forth the fantastical elements, he missed establishing primary characters beyond the recognizable tropes. So that we would care about what would happen with these characters. So I think ultimately, as much as I went in thinking, oh, I'm really anticipating, looking forward to watching the film, I was unfortunately disappointed. What about you?
I was disappointed as well. I felt let down. One of the things is, one of our favorite movies is The Void. And after watching The Void, we had a lot of folks say to us, you gotta watch Prince of Darkness. It's very similar. And plus, it's John Carpenter. I mean, the man bats, I'd say, 80% of the time is good, 20% of the time is Ghost of Mars. But you know, we all love The Thing. We all love Escape from L.A. No, Escape from New York. Not Escape from L.A. Oops. The Fog.
Let me get that in there.
Yeah, you know, we love all these good films. So, I was pumped. And so, I felt very let down because I really wanted to love this film. And I love the idea of the film. I like the idea of a group of experts getting together and they're trying to study like pure evil with science. And I think it's kind of a different take on, you know, in the prior decade, it was our decades, you know, you had more like the Rosemary's Baby and Omen type films where, you know, hey, Satan's coming to our world. Well, here's a more sciencey approach to it. Let's take it, look at it from that angle. And, you know, it's also a siege movie, and John Carpenter does those pretty well. So, just at the end, just like you, I mostly a character issue, which is, I think, what we'll get to in a second. I was let down. I wanted to love this film. So, let's talk about characters, because this movie doesn't have them.
It does. The characters take up space.
They do.
But there's a lot of reliance on kind of established tropes. To build out the characters, so, but there isn't much depth beyond what's in the surface.
I got a question for you. Can you even remember a single character's name?
The only one that I could remember was Susan, and that's because, well, Susan and Walter, and not in good ways. So, you know, because Susan was the butt of an ongoing joke throughout the film of when asked, hey, have you seen Susan? The response was always, who's Susan? You know, it felt kind of misogynistic. And of course, you know, she's dressed pretty casually. I mean, actually, to be honest, all are. She has large glasses. She's kind of nerdy. Not memorable. And I can't even remember what kind of scientific expertise she was really bringing to the group. And it didn't seem like any of the other characters did either. And I kind of felt that if you're doing a movie in which science is important, don't make your characters
dumb.
I didn't want to say dumb, but yeah, don't make them dumb. Don't make them flat. Make them believable. You know, have that competency of your characters, because initially, the professor, who you call Grandpa, is played by Walter Wong, which to me I thought was not a great casting choice, just because anytime I've ever seen Victor Wong, he's always been kind of a comedy, you know, or kind of a butt of jokes as well. So I felt like you really needed people in casted at various characters that would be a bit more, I don't know, bring some pedigree to what they've done, or have them completely unknown. So that way you don't know and you're not bringing preconceived notions about them. The other one was Walter, who I felt was a very, was really struggling with his identity. And when this was written was during the height of the AIDS epidemic. And, you know, I was reading about the movie and it was talking about how, you know, there's representations and references to homosexuality that's within the Walter character. And, you know, I never knew really what his scientific, you know, expertise was either. And the one kind of statement that stands out with me for him is the fact that he had a hot date. He really didn't want to stay at this church over the weekend. So unfortunately, yeah, I just don't think we have any strong characters. We don't have any characters that you really become invested in and you really want to know that they're going to survive and that they're going to come through. Hopefully unscathed and not too emotionally damaged at the end of the film.
Yeah, that to me is also, it's the breakdown of the film. You know, if you divide the movie in half, you know, the actual last half of the movie, as silly as it can be, it isn't bad. You know, it's just the standard, you know, running amok, clubbing each other in the head, finding out who's bad, who's not. But it's all the setup before that, and especially if the characters. That's why I asked, can you remember their names? I can't. None of them are memorable. I don't know who they are. Why should I care about them and what they contribute to the plot? I think of, here's a movie that does it perfectly, is like Event Horizon. You know, Sam Neill wakes up from his cryo sleep. He's on the crew of the Lewis and Clark, and, you know, it's just a quick 30-second scene. It's totally easy to do. It's just what you do in, like, a business setting. Everyone introduces themselves. You know, hi, I'm this person and I do this. Hi, I'm this person and I do that. And, of course, it helps. It's a small crew. But you know, at the end of the day, you know, that guy is medical, that guy's navigator, that guy's trauma, that guy is, you know, the worst case scenario person. They don't have something like this. I don't know what skills they bring to this. I mean, this movie really needed a scene of, you know, everyone arrives at the church. Why are we here? What's going on? You know, and they all introduce each other. Hi, I'm Bob from physics. Oh yeah, I'm Jill from Dead Languages. Well, that's weird. Why are we all here? And then all of a sudden, you know, Victor Wong comes out and says, you might all wonder why I brought you here. Ta-da! Canister of Satan. We are going to study this thing and do X, Y, and Z. Then I would get it. At that point now, the movie has truly been laid out, blueprinted, what's going on, who's doing what, why they're doing what. You're set up, and I'm okay with that. The first 30 minutes of this film is very slow at setting it up, and I'm usually okay with a slow burn. I mean, the actual intro is really ominous. It's like people are talking, but you don't hear them, and it keeps cutting the credits every couple minutes with the John Carpenter dark synth playing. I'm like, okay, this is cool, this is uneasy, but he forgot to set up characters, except for, like, oh, this guy likes that girl, and he's a teacher, and what? Who cares? And then, yeah. That feels bad. I'm okay with that, like, in a slasher film. Like, if this is a typical early 80s slasher film clone where it's a whole bunch of dumb teens in a cottage and they all get, you know, chainsawed, that's the purpose they serve, is to be cannon fodder. I don't think this movie was trying to do that. It actually wanted to be, here's specialized characters that have an impact on this world that's about to end, I think, because we're getting imagery of, like, you know, the sun and the moon not looking right, and, you know, insects acting weird, but it doesn't tick and tie in that, since the characters are just not there, they can't carry it.
Yeah, as you were talking, you know, you brought up Event Horizon. One of the there's two things that Event Horizon does, and I think, you know, real good horror films, is that, one, they limit the number of characters, so that way you can get at least beyond those recognizable tropes. Yeah, there, you know, you've got the mechanic, you've got the goof off, you've got the this or the that, but you also get a little bit more to hang your hat on so that you recognize each one and what they're bringing, you know, to the film in character. I, you know, the Event Horizon and Alien, I think they had at maximum 7 characters. And this movie, I think they had probably up to about 10 or 13.
Almost and, doubled.
Yeah, and unfortunately, it's been proven that that's too many people. When you're doing a film of this kind of nature, that it's too many people for an audience person to really, like, kind of, like, understand who everybody is and kind of keep track. And it, I think it was even hard for Carpenter to really place these people and have them doing something. And it just felt like it was overloaded with characters. And I think that if he pulled it back, done a core 7, each with their specialty. And then the other thing that I think has worked well, like in Event Horizon, Alien, and others, is having an establishing scene. And I felt like characters were coming in, they were coming out. We didn't really ever have all the characters together, per se, because I think Susan had already gone missing by that time. And, you know, others were moving around. So we didn't really have a good establishing scene of all these characters, so we could really see their faces, their names, what their specialty was, and how they kind of interact with mm-hmm. each other.
There is the equivalent of the dinner party scene from Alien in this, when they're all gathered around, and, you know, the one lady who's doing all the translating is, like, reading it off, and everyone's, like, getting scared. But, yeah, like, 4 characters are missing from that scene doing other things. Mm-hmm. I'm okay with more characters sometimes. I mean, it's just, you know, the nature of a horror film is you have lesser characters because it's cheap. But it also helps with the other aspect that this movie also needed, and that's the isolationist aspect. The idea mm-hmm. of you're in the cabin in the woods, there's not many of us, we're getting picked off, we're isolated. And here, they're in a church, they're surrounded by, you know, bloodthirsty transients, they can't get out, so, but it's hard to feel isolated when you've got, like, 20 folks, you know, running around and doing stuff. And so, And again, that's okay if, like, 15 of them are just background cannon fodder characters, and you have the five primary ones. Because, you know, movies like Jurassic Park or something, you have the cannon fodder characters, you don't care about them, and you have your core. This one, it's like you said, the core is spread too thin among too many characters that they're not memorable. We don't know who they are. We don't know what they do. You lose track of them. You lose track of, even though this is supposed to be a tight space, who is where? And
yeah, it's actually, it's a church, and it has like probably like two or three floors, and then it's got a basement. So there's a lot of territory to actually keep track of. And I mean, even though I think Alien and Event Horizon, I'm sorry to keep going back to those two.
Because
those
they're good. They set good. Nice standards.
You know, even though they're a little bit larger space, it's pretty confined. And I would say going back to The Void, it's a hospital, which should be very confusing. But because it is being decommissioned, they're not throughout the whole hospital. They're kind of at the front. They're in the emergency unit area. And they really don't go beyond that until they start, you know, going towards the basement area. I do want to bring up that there is an issue with being timeless. And I don't think that this is a movie that really stands the test of time. And one of the ways, and that's through the characters, is the Brian and Catherine relationship. Brian is played by Jameson Parker. And it's the early part of the film, we see him, he's like watching this girl, but it is in a very creepy, stalkerish type of way. And I think that would not do well now, because they hook up, they have sex. And I think maybe that still happens, but it just, given the kind of climate that we're in today and, you know, being more sensitive and being more understanding to things, the fact that he's stalking her, he's watching her, is pretty creepy.
So characters aside, I think one of the other kind of important moods of this film is the impending apocalypse, I guess, as it were, because this is movie two of the Informal Apocalypse trilogy. So I guess a question I would have is, did you actually feel into the worldish with this film as compared to The Thing and The Mouth of Madness?
Not like in The Mouth of Madness. And maybe The Thing, not a problem with The Thing, but the fact that it's so isolated made it a little more difficult to think in terms of a massive apocalypse. I think I felt that more with In the Mouth of Madness. I will say, though, the fact that the locale is kind of unique here, the fact that it's, you know, in the underbelly of L.A. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we do kind of discard, and it is kind of unseen, but the fact that it is kind of an urban environment makes it a little bit more concerning that it could be an apocalypse. And that it is in an urban setting versus, you know, like in the 50s where, you know, we'd have something apocalyptic hit Earth. But it was always in a kind of rural area. So I think that makes this a bit unique. And maybe there is a little bit of feeling that there's an apocalypse going on without our knowledge and the fact that it is in an urban environment. What about you?
See, I wasn't feeling that. And I think that's also just that kind of a establishment of mood going on. I mean, there's hints of it, like the transients are acting weird. The sun and the moon don't look quite right. There's a TV broadcast of like a supernova going on. And that's very Night of the Living Dead-ish. And, you know, all those together, I'm like, I can believe all that. That's awesome. But the problem is the world itself doesn't seem to be reacting that way. I mean, characters will stop and stare at the sun real quick, but there's never any commentary. There's never any, you know, mention of it's getting weird out there or it's getting kind of crazy. I mean, you have that in Mouth of Madness. In fact, I like to think that maybe John Carpenter righted ship when he did Mouth of Madness. He's like, yeah, actually, maybe you need to be a bit more overt that the world's not right. Because I could see that, you know, the canister with an anti-god or Satan in it has been unearthed. So, you know, Lovecraftian terms, the stars are now right. So, you know, things start getting I mean, we've read many tales or seen many movies of, you know, when something big's about to happen, you know, like the animals are acting kind of funny, people are getting more violent, and TVs are going to stat or whatever. And I expect all that stuff leading to an apocalypse in a more fantastic sense, and I wasn't getting that from this. Even though the imagery was there, it's just to get the characters aren't reacting that way. And I think that's kind of another thing they're not selling us on. If it wasn't an apocalypse going on or near end of the world, I'd more buy that. But it feels like there was trying to be. Unlike The Thing, which is, you know, apocalypse movie, because at the very end, the idea of, you know, Kurt Russell and the other guy are the only two alive, and one of them is probably The Thing. They're going to get out there and spread their thing germs over the world and stuff like that. And you know, we talked offline about this, that it's not part of the apocalypse trilogy, but we think it should be, and that's They Live. Mm-hmm. It seems like Prince of Darkness has John Carpenter elements that he just does better in other films. Like the depiction of the transients in this, led by Alice Cooper. You know, why are they weird because the apocalypse is coming? Are they weird because they're just drawn to this church now and the princess in there? Or are they just all just coincidentally schizophrenic and that's why they're there? Compare that to the depiction of, you know, transients and They Live, you know, with Roddy Piper and everything like that. You have the depiction of hard science. You know, this one it's so tacked on, and it's supposed to be kind of one of the more important parts of, we're going to use science to study this canister, but no one cares. And, you know, one of the kind of cliches in this is everyone says, don't jump to conclusions, but we're going to jump to conclusions. You know, compare that to the hard science-y stuff in They Live, which isn't super hard science, but you have the scientists in Antarctica going, what is this thing? Let's study it. Let's capture it. You know, perform a little bit of autopsy or whatever on it. You know, I buy them as scientists doing their science-y things. So, I don't know. It feels like some of Carpenter's main things that he's known for are as explored in other movies are just done better in other movies, which help establish those movies' moods, characters, plot, and so on.
Yeah, I think part of the issue is going back to the characters, the actors. I think that they did what they could, but they probably didn't have enough to work with to really shine in their respective characters, because they just didn't have a whole lot to go on. And I don't think that they were able to kind of solidify their motivations in the film. And again, I think, you know, it's kind of a petri dish. Like you say, I totally agree. I feel like John Carpenter, I think this was a passion project in my mind. He really wanted to look at religion. He wanted to look at physics. He wanted to try a blending with the fantastical or the futurism. And as much as he cared about those themes, I just don't think it came together. I just think that he didn't have enough there to really hook everything together and sew it up and really have a tight narrative. And I think that, yes, with They Live, even though it wasn't like hard, real hard science or anything, it was more believable. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because the character, the actors were, you know, involved with their characters. They understood the motivations. They knew where they were going from point A at the beginning of the film to point B at the end of the film. And I think all that kind of stuff is jumbled in this film.
Well, you know, the thing is, it's been a while since I watched They Live, but, you know, the idea of accepting the truth that, you know, something weird's going on. In They Live, it's alien invasion. They've already taken over us. Billboards are weird. While in Prince of Darkness, it's like Jesus was a space alien that came to Earth, and there's an anti-god, and, you know, the characters are like, you know, this is BS, I can't believe it. You know, they Live just does a better job, I think, of trying to overcome those believable boundaries. I mean, there's even a scene where Roddy Piper's trying to force the magic glasses on another character. Oh, you gotta see this now, I don't want you. And this one, it's like, they get some bombshells dropped on them, but you know, one character's like, well, I'm tired, I'm gonna go to bed, and this is this fooey, and you know, I'm like, guys, you're scientists, you know, this should be like, we are looking at one of the craziest things in the entire world that's apparently older than Earth itself. It can only be opened up inside, and it's none of our equipment's working very well. So, they don't act like that. And to your point about characters again, about maybe being miscast or something, you know, these are all students, and they're all older actors playing students, so it's either a case of these truly are older students further along in their academic career, and if that's the case, why are they so immature? Or they're trying to be young students, and this is really bad casting by older people with big old 70s mustaches and stuff.
Yeah, I...
Creepy, back to your stalking point earlier.
Yeah, I just think it comes down to the fact that there were themes in there that just was... Carpenter was just not up for putting together. I think the interest was there, but then when you're talking about religious themes, I think that Donald Pleasance, when he and the professor are talking together, it became a point of like trying to almost like brain dump info to try to help the plot. Because to be honest, our students don't necessarily know everything that's going on, other than trying to grapple with Satan is in liquid form down in the basement, and there's an anti-god. Well, how do you work with there's a god and an anti-god? There's actually a lot of really interesting themes, and I think that it just didn't flow together. It's a great, unique idea, and I think it's a fascinating one, but it just didn't come together in this film.
Well, you know who else does info dumps in their works? Certain man named H.P. Lovecraft.
So, oh, well, there we go.
So let's change focus here. Let's talk about some of the Lovecrafty things and some of the good things, because there is some cool stuff in Prince of Darkness, and of course this is a Lovecraftian podcast, so we gotta talk about some Lovecraft stuff. I do want to bring up for Lovecraft stuff, because this is cosmic horror, but in a different way, because it's not like Cthulhu or Yog-Sothoth or anything like that. It's actually trying to position, like, Satan and an anti-god is a real concept, folks. I mean, that these are cosmic deities, and so I think the movie's trying to bridge a gap between, you know, the Omen, Rosemary's Baby, Beyond the Door religious horror with cosmic horror by taking one set and put it in the other. And I think that's kind of a noble attempt to do, in a different way to tackle cosmic horror. I would never associate, like, Space Jesus with cosmic horror, but, I mean, here we are. Mirrors. Mirrors play a big part in this movie towards the end, and we've on our end have read some really good Lovecraftian stories of mirrors. Now, I know there's folklore around mirrors, like, you know, steal your soul or portals to other worlds or something, but, you know, when we rebooted our podcast, we took a look at Children of Glackey, and there was the story of, by John Langan, mirror fishing, which is, you know, they're fishing in a mirror, and there's a, you know, Glackey god at the bottom of the mirror and all the liquid and stuff. I'm like, well, it's Prince of Darkness right there. And there's also a Army of Darkness. It's crossover with Reanimator, which is definitely a Lovecraft work, but in that comic series, you know, Ash gets stuck in a mirror world in that one as well. So I think the mirror scenes in this, while, you know, not first generation Lovecraft, are definitely Lovecraftian. When the character, like, sticks her two fingers in the compact mirror and it's peering on the other side, that was kind of cool and creepy. And then even as the anti-god's arm is cheesy, let's just be honest with that, but the concept of him coming through the mirror
it
and
made
summing
me think
it,
of, like, what is it, Thanos or something? Yeah, you know,
this big red Satan arm, this legend with Tom Cruise and Tim Curry, you know, that kind,
yeah,
of, but I mean, that stuff is cool, you know, the idea that, you know, the mirrors are truly a portal to a, you know, a cosmic realm.
Yeah, I would add to that the presence of dreams,
mm-hmm,
and how they have messaging in them and how it brings people together. I mean, we've definitely seen that in The Mouth of Madness, which is also kind of a Lovecraftian-esque type of film. And we've even read that in a variety of things over the years.
Dreams of the Witch House is probably the biggest one.
Yes, that's with true.
Dreams, yeah. And they're also trying to resurrect a god in that one. So I think you're right on Dreams of the Witch House is probably a big...
Yeah.
Invisible hand shaper to this film.
Yeah, and I can't actually recall because, like you, it's been quite a while since I've seen The Thing.
Mm-hmm.
But for overarching between all three of the films that mm-hmm. make these a trilogy, the concept of dreams is at least in Prince of Darkness and in The Mouth of Madness. I don't know if it was in The Thing or not, but, I think that is kind of interesting that at least for those two, dreams... play a larger factor.
Yeah, it's been a while for a thing. I don't think there's dreams in The Thing. But yeah, correct. In this one, the dreams act as a transportation method of information from the future. They even said, this is not a dream. And I do got to point out that the not-a-dream-dream sequences is sampled in so many industrial and synthwave bands out there that there's actually a band called 2600, a synthwave band that samples it, and other industrial bands. I just gotta point that out that, you know, there's folks that still look at this text and take something from it. But, actually, I should say, on the subject of music, the music is still top-notch for Prince of Darkness. This is John Carpenter doing dark synth even better, I would say, than Halloween. It's good, it's moody, it's ominous. I dig it.
Yeah, and it's very Carpenter-esque. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's always... I mean, that's just part of his auteur element, is that, you know, we have, you know, his music in the film. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it gives a level, I don't know, a level of comfort, because, you know, this is Carpenter... traditional Carpenter, because his music's actually in there.
But it also shows him slipping to the dark side that we'd see in Ghost of Mars and trying to do more heavy metal, because he's got Alice Cooper in this film, and apparently, you know, Alice Cooper made a song for the film called Prince of Darkness, and I apparently it's only in one scene, and it can just barely be heard through the headphones of a character that gets killed by the transients, and that's it, you know? So what happens after that? Then we go to In the Mouth of Madness, which has the fake Metallica score. And
which
then,
I actually like.
And then we're in Ghost of Mars, which is full on, you know, throw the goat metal.
Well, at least he came back to his roots in the mid around 2015 when he did Lost Themes, which is a very good album. I would also say that, you know, we have this idea of cult,
mm-hmm.
and going back to The Void, mm-hmm. we have the cult members that are all hooded and very mysterious. And, you know, even though we can see the faces of the homeless people, and Alice Cooper is an exception, we know exactly who he is, no matter what kind of makeup he has on, we know that's him. But with the rest of them, the way they are looking around, or they look up at the sun, and they just kind of stand there, it is a creepy factor, and it's one that we've seen in other Lovecraftian films and what we've read about.
Wait, hold on. I just had a thought occur in my head, because one of the themes that occurs in a lot of John Carpenter films, aside from the breakdown of society, is the implied breakdown of, like, capitalism and authority.
Mm-hmm.
Escape from New York, you know, total failure of capitalism there. Mouth of Madness is unchecked capitalism of, we're going to crank out these books even though they make people crazy. So I'm going to throw this out there as a conspiracy theory. What if the Alice Cooper transient really is Alice Cooper? I mean, in canon of the story, it's like Alice Cooper's album's bombed, and now he's broke, and now he's a transient on the street. I mean, if that's the case, it would add another kind of little layer to his, John Carpenter's normal themes out there of, man, if this can happen to Alice Cooper, you know, this can happen to you. I know that's not true, but why not? I mean, come on, it's Alice Cooper as a transient. I can't... what? You know, it kind of breaks a little bit of character there. But I do want to say, with the Void, the transits are spooky because they've got, like, all the bugs around them that come out of the blue and slash people. But the Void, the cultists in the Void with the sheets over them, and they're all uniform and not moving, there's something more eerie about that. And we do got to say, the Void, you know, similar film. I mean, they end the same way, you know, someone being body checked through a portal. You know, they're trapped in a building by cultists or transients. There's also possession factors, and the cult, and the Void people get possessed, and this one they also get possessed. I mean, I could see why folks were telling us, hey, watch Prince of Darkness after watching The Void. It's just that The Void is Jeff's kiss.
Yeah, I would say, you know, watch Prince of Darkness and then watch The Void. One of the things that I was going to comment with regards to your conspiracy theory, I'll throw in my two cents about conspiracy theory. You know, Carpenter uses the higher education state, as a institution. And, I mean, we could talk about that he is breaking down an established institution at a school level, one that we don't always see. So that could be kind of a progressive aspect of this film, is that you have these characters, these are students, they're supposed to be like on their last year or two of becoming doctors and, you know, subject matter experts of their fields. And yet we see that there isn't really any competency. They're you know, sex-crazed young people, and they can't seem to deduce anything without really being spoon-fed. And so, you know, Carpenter has made a lot of statements about the breakdown of capitalism, and I'll put in there 2 cents that maybe he's also commenting about the breakdown of
education system.
Well, there's my conspiracy theory.
But, you know, let's throw this out there. What? Let's say they're successful. I'm just going to throw this out there. Victor Wong has these students. Hey, guys, we got a top secret project. Come on over. We're going to solve this. What happens in real world? You know, if you're an Egyptologist and you invite your students on the dig and you find something exceptional, who gets the credit for that?
The Egyptologist.
Yeah, the Egyptologist does. So, you know, the alternate ending of this movie is Victor Wong going, oh yeah, I'm super famous now. I've uncovered the secrets of the universe and Satan. I had some help from my students, obviously, but me.
Yeah,
I'm just saying that's another possibility had the movie gone slightly differently.
Yes, this would be the, you know, professor's essay in the journal with maybe some footnotes that, oh, by the way, these students were involved in the collection of the data presented on further in this study.
You know, I think that other professor that they brought in, to be more serious.
Oh, Dr. Leahy.
I think he's the actual type of character that would do that. Not Victor Wong, necessarily, because I think he's more humble, more down-to-earth, and more revered of his topic. Yeah, there's this other character they introduced, Dr. Leahy. He makes a big deal, like, I'm here, where's everyone, set up my equipment, what have you found out? But I don't know what he does. I do know he's kind of a prick, and he's kind of, you know, bossy, and he demands people call him doctor, so there's that, you know. Oleana, that's what I was thinking of, the movie play Oleana by, who wrote Glengarry Gill and Ross?
David Mamet.
David Mamet film, that's it, all about power dynamics of our teachers over students. That's what that guy's kind of representing. But at the end of the day, still, I'm like, but what are you doing? What are you deciphering? What equipment are you looking at? Why are you... It turns out, you know, he's just there for cannon fodder, just, you know, whatever, but, so anyway, I think there could be the definite distrust of education there, because ultimately, it fails everyone in this. What happens at the end, the football-playing tactic of body-checking someone is what saves the day.
Yeah. I have one last point. And that's with regards to looking at this movie within the trilogy of films. This film seems to be successful with subverting the apocalypse. You know, religion is usually paired with the idea of faith and hope, while science, I think, really tries to rationalize that faith and hope into actual data that you can see and you can replicate. And I think this film's hope succeeds because of the human tenacity over religion and science. And so that, to me, was kind of an interesting... There's a bit more hope with this film than there is with The Thing and In the Mouth of Madness.
Those two are way more cynical films than this. Yeah, mm-hmm. At the end, you know, there are people who are rescued that make it out alive. And in fact, maybe that's why folks don't consider They Live part of the apocalypse thing. But if you think about it, They Live ends on the same note as this film, that the good guys technically win. I mean, Roddy Piper shoots the antenna and exposes, hey, the world has already been invaded. I mean, I guess at that point you're technically post-apocalypse. But, you know, the next step is, you know, how do we combat this? How do we repel them? What do we do about this? And I think the same questions can be asked, you know, what comes after Prince of Darkness as well. That there is that hope that, okay, we've unearthed what's going on. We know that there's an anti-god in the mirror. I put him there. He could come back at any time. We know that there's aliens disguised as our politicians. We know that. I think they both end on a less cynical note and more on a hope note. I would say, yeah, you're about correct. And with that, that would be my proposal. Bring They Live into the apocalypse quadrilogy.
There we go. And I think with that, we're going to take a quick musical intermission, and then we'll be back to finish up the episode with our thank yous and upcoming events. Welcome back. We would like to thank David Rose for providing this episode's opening bumper. We had the pleasure of interviewing David on our transmission episode that released in April. David is the author of No Joy, a Recon Marine's Tales of Self-Destruction, Lucky Joe, and of course, Lovecraft's Iraq. We wish David much continued success, and please do check out David's social media details in the show notes.
So, upcoming events. On Friday the 30th, we'll be releasing our transmissions episode this month, which includes our interviews with Brenda Estolian and Ian Welke. Brenda will be discussing her collection, Blood Mountain, while Ian will be chatting with us about his newest novel, Union Station. Additionally, we have some other upcoming appearances. I was just on the Fan the Fan podcast discussing John Carpenter's In the Mouth of Madness, so that episode will hopefully drop soon, and you can listen to that one in tandem with this one. Michelle will be on Galactic Terrors, the YouTube show put on by HWA New York, on October 13th, doing a nonfiction reading about the horror comic book artist Bernie Wrightson. We'll update the show notes with links once the show's post.
We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Our website is hplovecast.com. And of course, you can also email us at hplovecast@gmail.com. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and feel free to explore our archives. We've got quite a few episodes there now, don't we?
Yes, we do.
Consider supporting us by purchasing our books. We each have Amazon author pages with links to all the books we have either edited or contributed to with individual essay chapters. Or if you feel like donating a dollar or two, we have a coffee account. We have Dutch Brothers here in Phoenix, and we'd love to get a cup of coffee. A link is provided in the show notes. As always, thank you for listening.